For CertSecurity.com, I'm Rob Westerveld. You're listening to Security Wire Weekly for July 2nd, 2008. In this edition, we'll talk about the latest wave of SQL injection attacks. Joining us is Scott Matsumoto. He's a principal consultant with secure software coding vendor Cigital. We'll hear what he has to say about it and what can be done about it. Matsumoto is an expert in secure coding practices. Also, the news, the PCI requirement for securing web applications takes effect. Up next, Scott Matsumoto on SQL injection attacks, but first, this message.
When it comes to analyzing a network, protecting enterprise data, or fighting malware, you can plop down thousands of dollars for a commercial product, or you can get tons of great functionality from a free tool. Let CertSecurity.com show you how some of the industry's best free and open source tools work in our exclusive screencast series. Each month, one of CertSecurity.com's best experts will offer a step-by-step video presentation showing you how to use the most powerful tools and software, including Nessus, Snort, UTM, and so much more. And it's all free. Don't wait. Watch and learn today. Visit CertSecurity.com/screencast. That's CertSecurity.com/screencast.
And we're back. Researchers have been tracking a growing wave of SQL injection attacks targeting vulnerable websites, and the problem is the faulty coding behind the website. Microsoft has recently responded, identifying several tools that could be used by software developers and QAs in the software development process. And joining us to talk about this is Scott Matsumoto. Scott is a principal consultant with secure software coding vendor Cigital. He'll share what companies can do to protect themselves and what software developers and QAs should do during the software development lifecycle. Scott, thanks for joining us.
No problem.
Let's start with this wave of SQL injection attacks. Can you define what a SQL injection attack is for our audience? And then why suddenly, this is sort of an old school method, why suddenly this massive wave of attacks?
A SQL injection is an attack where a web-based application takes in user input, and that user input eventually is passed to the SQL backend processor, like the SQL database, Oracle, MySQL, SQL Server, and it's done in such a way that the SQL processor confuses the user data for code, and an attacker is able to, instead of putting your name in, they'll put in something that tricks the SQL engine to run the query that the attacker wants. So he effectively modifies the query through user input.
Why suddenly this massive wave of attacks that we've been hearing about probably since the beginning of the year, right?
Well, to be honest, I actually took a look at some of the references. Some of the references, I think there's a little bit of confusion in the press. Because one of the vulnerabilities that's been reported about for the Microsoft vulnerability that's been reported actually isn't a SQL injection attack. It's actually a Windows vulnerability that can manifest in either IIS or SQL Server. And somewhere, some author picked up on this and has decided that this was SQL injection, but it's not. It does turn out, though, that SQL injection is probably the second most prevalent attack for web-based applications. So I think there's this little bit of confusion, and then everyone's picked up on it.
Well, Microsoft pretty much caught wind of it as well, and they came out with an advisory about it, and then identified some tools that could be used by software developers. Can we talk a little bit about them?
Sure. I think, and let me clarify, I think the Microsoft advisory is about the Windows vulnerability, and
okay.
It mentioned SQL Server. I think there was an HP advisory that talks about Scrawler, which then says, well, okay, you can, it kind of confundles the issue where it says, oh, okay, we've got this vulnerability from reported by Microsoft. Oh, it must be related to SQL. Well, therefore, we can use Scrawler to detect the
So why would somebody want to use this one of let's start with one of these tools, the URL scan tool.
I think of all the tools, that's probably the least useful. Yeah, I mean, you're just blocking particular URLs, and I suppose that in certain types of HTTP operations,
mm-hmm.
That's not going to be very effective against an SQL injection, because, again, you're trying to... The problem with an SQL injection is usually there's some piece of application functionality. It's a logon... I mean, the canonical one is the logon screen, but any place where you have an HTTP form where you can take user input,
mm-hmm.
And that input is handled as a character string, which is probably every form on your application, and that information then gets passed back to an SQL query, which is probably now we're down to about 80% of your front end HTTP post.
Sure.
I'm sorry, HTTP forms.
Right.
You know, those things are all potentially vulnerable, depending on how you wrote your code. So, if we can, I'd like to talk a little bit about Scrawler.
Sure.
Because that's where everything started, was from Scrawler.
And that's the vulnerability scanner.
Yeah. And with Scrawler we call it a dynamic tool. And we call it dynamic because it executes at runtime. And when the application is running, what it tries to do is it looks for all of the URL parameters. So it looks looking for these forms, and it's going to try to put some malicious code in and actually see if it finds it all the, you know, if it gets all the way to the back end. And it can detect based on the page results whether or not, you know, the data in the post was interpreted as data or whether it was interpreted as code. So that's great because you've got a running application, you can take a look at it. It will find certain percentage of them.
And who would be using this? A software developer or a QA?
Either a QA, probably more likely someone in QA or a security specialist, an application security specialist that in a company. It turns out that security problems like this are starting to become a specialty within QA organizations, much like performance testing or usability testing.
Mm-hmm.
There's specific, just you have to have your specific set of tools, you have a specific set of skills and knowledge that are just a little bit outside what a normal QA organization might have. I'd like to contrast that, though, with the Microsoft tool, and there are a bunch of other tools that are like this, the source code analyzer.
Mm-hmm.
The Microsoft source code analyzer is what we call a static analysis tool. Static meaning that the code is not executing. What it does is it goes through your code, the source code, and it looks for patterns in the code that are potentially injectable. For example, it looks for strings being concatenated and then being passed on to the SQL processor. The static analysis tools are actually quite are much more useful than the dynamic ones because they don't require that the code be executing, and therefore they can hit all of the parts of the code as opposed to the dynamic ones, which are reliant on the code path. Right? What I mean by that is when you're testing an application, you have to force the execution of different paths through the code, all the ifs and the checks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The static analysis tool doesn't do any of that. It's just looking at the source code going, oh, does this look like it might be, is this thing talking to the SQL processor? Yes, it is. Oh, does it have some input? Yes, it does. Is it concatenating it? Yep. Well, this thing could possibly be a problem, so I'm going to flag it. And you get much better coverage out of a static analysis tool.
These tools aren't as robust as some of the major tools on the market. Do you have any idea how much time this would introduce to the software development lifecycle if suddenly developers and QAs and the security specialists within the development group started using these tools?
Yeah, it's actually not very much, actually, if you use them correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take the dynamic tests. I think it came out of the HP research. But I think the group they have Web Inspect. It's the HP tools. It's web inspect, dev inspect, and QA inspect. They all run on the same engine.
Mm-hmm.
And they can run, they run a battery of tests against the application. They just and it takes, depending on the test, you know, you can configure it. But it could take anywhere from, you know, 10 minutes to a half an hour. And then you have to go through the results. Which is not, you know, that's not unreasonable. I think the hardest part is the first time going through the results and making sure that everything is, that, that you, you sort out which are really true findings versus what are things that it, that it, it thinks it found, but it really didn't. The static tools, are probably done. I mean, there's many ways of deploying it. A very easy way to do it would be to do it in your nightly build process. And it's just like your compiler. You run it through the static analysis tool. It'll have a bunch of findings. You mark them. You know, you mark the ones that are false as false positives, and so it doesn't keep warning you about them. And then at the end of, you know, you're at the end of your build, you check to see if there are any new findings. If they're none, then everything's fine. You know, they aren't going to find every single SQL injection, but they find a good number, and you know, it's kind of a good base set of processes to have in your software development lifecycle.
So, are more developers and are more people around the development lifecycle starting to use these tools more often?
Yeah, I think that across our customers, we see a lot of people with dynamic tools. We see them with with Web Inspect. We see a good amount of App Scan. And then we're starting to see organizations that have are moving towards the static tools as well. I think depending on the you know how many web applications you have and the criticality of the data, you may want to look at some at manual analysis because there are definitely problems that exist, vulnerabilities that exist in these code in these applications that the tools can't find.
Like what? Can you give an example?
Well, the easiest ones to describe are the ones where you have two users, and they're effectively the same at the same level in your entitlements hierarchy. So, imagine that you and I. Well, let's use an example. Imagine you and I were on a site, and we were both users of the site. And the site, maybe you and I are filling out applications for a job, right?
Mm-hmm.
My information about my background, you know, how much I make, that's all pretty sensitive information, as is yours. And, but what will happen is I'll be identified by some number, say it's 27, and you're identified by some number, say it's 38. The applications will take 38, and it may just, it may just process it, and even though it wasn't me, number 27, that actually passed that data along. So the tools aren't smart enough to understand that this number, 28, is different from, you know, it represents a user or it represents some particular business object.
Right.
And it's really easy to fool the web-based application that way. And again, the tools just aren't smart enough to find that yet.
So let's go back then, backtrack a bit to the original question, which is why are there so many sites out there that seem to be vulnerable
this? Yeah, that's a good question. Well, it has to do with the nature of web-based applications. I guess back in, you know, right around the turn of the century, there's this N-tier web-based application architecture came out where you have the browser, the thin client browser on the front end, and then there's some business logic. I mean, there's a web server, processes pages, and we wanted, you know, the applications wanted to be able to process SQL queries. So there was these dynamic protocols to talk to the SQL engines. And what happens is that the applications are building the queries during runtime and passing them to the SQL engine that's interpreting them. And with all of this dynamic behavior, the constructing of the query at runtime, using user input to mix in with to construct the query, it's just the attackers figured out that they can confuse the application to pass in data as code, and it's just inherent in that architecture of application.
How quickly can you correct a site that's been targeted with a SQL injection attack?
So it's going to depend on how many places you have to fix. Just because you're changing code. Really to fix it, you're going to have to do a code change. You can use there are some monitoring techniques that you could use to detect kind of outside of the code, but those kinds of application or database firewalls they're not a complete solution. I think the problem, the code change is relatively straightforward, and it's just a question of how many you have, and it could be a day, it could be 4 days. There's fairly low risk change. The biggest thing is knowing what to change and how to change it. And that goes back to, is there good guidance out there? And if you can find some good stuff out there and you can find some bad stuff out there. So,
in terms of detection, are most companies solely reliant on their customers to find out whether their site has been victimized?
I think that if you're concerned about it and you want to put in place the right level of security, there are a lot of great monitoring tools that monitor database activity. A good database monitoring tool, and there are a number out there in the marketplace, can do baselining on queries and allow you to see when there's activity that's outside of the norm. That would be that's a very easy and cost-effective way of putting in a control to figure out if you're being victimized by a SQL injection. The other is, the other more systemic way of dealing with it is to look at how you develop code. Use the static analysis tools, use code reviews, and various other secure development lifecycle techniques.
Mm-hmm.
So the combination of that set of techniques is very, very effective.
It's just all about being proactive then.
It is about being proactive, yes.
And finally this week, the PCI data security standard requirement for securing web applications took effect. Requirement 6.6 gives merchants and other organizations the need to be PCI compliant. It gives two options for protecting web applications. That's application code reviews and web application firewalls. The requirement has been a best practice for 2 years, and that gives companies a long lead time to put a strategy in place, according to experts. The PCI Security Standards Council said that proper implementation of both options would provide the best multi-layer defense. It issued a guidance on that earlier this year. Still, some analysts say that it's likely that some firms will choose a compensating control to meet the standard. Well, that does it for this edition of Security Wire Weekly. Be sure to check out our previous podcast by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For now, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.